On today's episode of Open Kwong Door, Adrian Arsenault.
Okay, it's rolling.
It's rolling, people.
I got nothing. I don't know what to say.
Welcome to Open... Oh, I'll start that one again.
So I think this was such a... It was such an interesting interview because kind of like... similar to when you talk to Gord Stellick, it's kind of really cool to hear those people that are reporting stories all the time and to hear their stories that they're not really, you know, their personal sort of feelings about what's going on, and that they kind of have to keep in check in what you was talking about in the interview about whether it's being objective or, you know, all of that kind of stuff.
Well, it was interesting. Before before the microphone got switched on, we were talking briefly about awards. So I said, you know, how many Gemini Awards? She said, well, gee, I'm not sure. And she said, well, I think there was... And I thought to myself, you know, that's the hallmark of somebody who truly loves their job. They have no recollection of awards, because it's not what's important. What seems to drive Adrian Arsenault is the storytelling, and it humbles me to see the passion with which she does her job. And as I said to her, I felt that it's her humanity that's the hallmark of her success, because I feel like the stories matter to her when I watch her. Mm-hmm. Now we have an interesting connection. Our dads were very close friends, and I knew her. I'm a couple of years older. Okay, four. In my childhood. And so she has a picture of me at her first birthday party. So it was really fun to reconnect. We didn't reconnect until I came to CBC. So to be able to bridge the gap of quite a few intervening decades to figure out what's been going on in her life was really wonderful. And the fact that I'm a huge fan, I was just really delighted that she said yes.
So how did you feel talking to somebody that sort of does a similar thing to you, but in a kind of different, totally different
way?
Content and context and subject matter and everything.
Well, you know, we're both storytellers. The difference is I'm paid to have an opinion about the stories that I tell. And so that gives me, I think, some freedom and some latitude to be able to present a story in a certain way. So she was talking at some length during the interview about stories and the fact that what she's looking for is a fair portrayal. Some people believe that balanced means that if you give 12 minutes to this person, then you give 12 minutes to the other side. And she said that isn't always the case, because in a story, there are lots of different sides, never just two. So to be able to find a way of presenting a fair story, a fair and balanced story, is really the trick. So, but the other thing is, there's very few tears in my line of work. I mean, from time to time, there's a tragic story like a Joanie Rochette at the Olympics, but not a lot. And in her life, in her storytelling, there are a lot of tears. So I was wondering how she didn't drown in them.
Well, you know, I don't, it's almost like I kind of just, I don't even let, we should talk about it after, because I just kind of want to get to all these sort of things that she talks about. It's very sort of interesting. She's got a lot of different stories.
It was humbling.
Yeah.
Anyway, I hope you like it. Adrian Arsenault.
On today's episode, well, she's a foreign correspondent for CBC with a track record of bringing the world's most important stories into our homes. From Europe and the Middle East, from right here at home, elections, war-torn countries, and natural disasters. She's a several-time Gemini Award winner and American Society of Professional Journalists Award winner. Please welcome Adrian Arsenault.
Hey.
Hola. Okay, so I have to come clean. We knew each other as children, but haven't seen each other in a while. Let's just put it that
Let's
way.
Put it, I do have a picture of you at my first birthday party,
which was 7 or 8 years ago now.
Exactly.
Now, the interesting thing is that, of course, I know that you're here, but I'm actually in the building more often than you are, because you are often on the road. So I want you to start off, please, by telling me, what was little Adrian like, for real?
Well, you probably know better than
I
most
do.
People.
So I'm going to see if you're going to lie.
Oh, what? You know, I think I like to, you know, I'm an only child, right?
Yes.
So it was, there was a lot of time spent with adults and listening to adult conversations and adult stories. And I always kind of found them neat. And my dad was a television director, so I spent a lot of time being babysat by him on set. So he'd go direct these comedies, and I would get plunked in the makeup room. And I'd come home, you know, with crazy hair and crazy eyes. And I would spend all my days watching what happened in the studio. And so, you know, I just remember being completely fascinated by these elements of an adult world. But, you know, I was one of those kids whose socks didn't match because I couldn't be bothered to
Sorry,
match
Mom, she wanted them
it's
to.
It's true. My mother absolutely did, but I would tear out of the house just to go and play, probably shirt on backwards, socks mismatched, to my mom's horror. But I just wanted to always be out there.
So where does the natural curiosity come from? And did it show itself when you were a kid?
You know, I didn't know that I always wanted to be a journalist, but my family and my friends say, oh, well, we knew. And we're fairly sure you knew. You just didn't know you knew. because there are constantly pictures of me either pretending to hold a microphone or actually holding one of my dad's microphones, interviewing my parents at dinner, holding, you know, random conversations with pretend anchormen from the time of like 6 or 7. So I don't know. I think I was scared of the world my dad was in, which was entertainment television, because as fun and light as it appears.
And sports, too. He was also in sports.
Absolutely. He was first director of Hockey Night in Canada.
Yep.
So, you know, I know it was a very difficult era. And I think the difficulties kind of frightened me a little bit. But I liked the true stories that got told. And they got told in a different part of the building. They got told in the news division. And I kind of liked it.
So tell me about, as a small child, I was a worried child. Mm. So news would never have been something that I ever would have watched because it would have scared me, honestly. And there are days still where I think, you know what, I just can't face it. So as a small child, the terrible things that go on, were they not frightening to you? Were you able to separate yourself even at that time?
Well, I think it was just part of the landscape of my life that, you know, I did not, and I joke with people now, I didn't actually realize that the radio, that there were options on the radio other than CBC, because we had one of those old radios where the on-off switch and all the buttons were pretty much worn. And so the way you just plugged it in or you unplugged it, and when you plugged it in, the sound of CBC came on, and when you unplugged it, CBC went away. So every meal was spent listening to As It Happens. And we would
love that show.
Yeah, as did I. I mean, we talked about the news. We talked about everything, my mom, dad, and I. Every story that came up, we talked about. And we weren't afraid to talk about it. Now, there may have been things that they hid from me, that they would, you know, direct me to go go run outside.
Yeah.
If there was something really horrible going on, and I just don't know. But I don't ever remember them saying, oh, this is not for kids. So we talked about it a lot. And I think in talking about it, it demystified it.
So tell me, so you've been working at CBC since 1991.
Yeah.
So that's a very long career to have at one place and always in news. So what makes a good news reporter?
Well, it's funny when you say always in one place and always in news, because for me, I don't...
Lots of locations, though.
Yeah, I don't think of it like that. I mean, I have a hard time conjuring 2 days that were the same.
Yep.
In the course of 20-some-odd years. I mean, it's true. I have lived all over the place. I lived in Jerusalem, London, Washington, Vancouver, a couple times in Toronto. And each one of those places has served as a jumping-off point for another place.
You know, yep.
Pakistan, Zimbabwe, you know, you name it. We've sort of been lucky enough to be there. And the way we tell stories has changed significantly, too. So, yes, I've primarily been a television reporter, but we do radio. We do online. We do galleries.
Yep.
We spend a lot of time tweeting.
I love Twitter.
You know, we basically, the stories are always different.
Yep.
The way you tell them is always different. The length of story you always tell is different. That the technology you use is constantly changing. And the way people listen to stories and the styles in which you use to edit is always changing. So it's been one place, but many different jobs.
What's your favorite?
My favorite?
Job. Aspect to your job.
I mean, I love being out there. I love being shot out of a cannon and landing somewhere dusty and trying to... My mom says that's my natural habitat, is covered in a thin layer of dust somewhere.
You wear it well, though, girl.
But I quite love being an outsider in somewhere new where your senses are really acute and you spend so much time saying, what is with that? That is sort of my favorite moment, is that sense of wonder when you, you know, a place smells new, it sounds new, and you're trying to understand what is happening to those people. And then you're trying to figure out how to make it connect with people really far away in back in Canada. How to shrink the geography. That's sort of what I find is really cool, is how to find ways to shrink the geography between places and situations.
I've always wondered, so when we see you in a dangerous place, mm-hmm. a war-torn place or a place that's unstable, first of all, is the idea for the story, does it start in a safer place and then they send you there? And then once you're there, how do you keep yourself safe?
Well, I mean, things can turn south
quickly
when you don't expect it. So you can be in a place that you consider to be okay and things go south. You can go to a place that you... are going to, like Libya, for example. You know, when we went, it was quite unstable and we knew things were changing. And yet most of your days there can be okay, you know. And it's a series of microscopic decisions that you make. You know, which vehicle do we use? Okay, so is the vehicle a low profile or high profile? Do you have, you know, vanity curtains so that people can't look in? What do you think of the driver? Is everybody happy? We've made sure nobody's got any weapons in the car, you know, that the driver doesn't have any, for example. Okay, so then we go down this road. Are we going to turn left or right? What's happened to the people who've gone before us on this road? It's just these series of calculations that you're making all the time. And there's still no guarantee. Bad things can happen mm-hmm. when you've been incredibly smart. And bad things have happened to people who have done all their homework. And other people who really shouldn't get away with it do get away with it. So we kind of sometimes have a code of the road where, you know, in a couple situations I've been in where the people who are the most nervous in the car win. So nobody gets bullied into saying, oh, come on, we
suck
are going
up.
Down this road, suck
yeah.
it up. That doesn't happen. We talk it through. And if there's a rational reason for not going forward, we don't go forward. If it's just, hang on, I need a moment, I just have to think about this, and then we move forward. But, you know, there are no crazies out there. There are no heroes out there that I've seen, that people who decide they want to do this for the sake of bravado. I know that happens, and I have heard stories of it happening, but I've been really lucky that everywhere I've been, the teams have always been, we've always been good guys. You know, everybody watches each other's back and looks out for each other.
And you have to really trust the team you're with.
Oh, completely.
I mean, have you worked with many of the same people over the course of time?
And that is the amazing part of it. When I was based in both London and Jerusalem, for those stretches of about 4 years each time, it was always the same producer and always the same cameraman, give or take one or two people. And you develop a lovely rhythm. I mean, you can imagine it in all
sure.
sorts of careers where you develop a lovely rhythm. You know that this guy needs to eat every 3 hours
or
he's going to become a hairy monster. You know, you know that this one does need a lot of sleep, but should be encouraged to sleep. You know somebody else is incredibly organized and someone else can be a bit forgetful, but is brilliant. So you start to learn these rhythms of your friends and your colleagues, and you learn to trust each other. And I've had so many times where I've not only worked with people, but we end up going on vacation together too, and you sort of move it as this neat little unit, and people are thinking, God, we have to separate them one day.
Do you know what's so interesting? Both in your line of work and in mine, people look at it from the outside and believe it to be one thing, mm-hmm. when in fact it's very different. So when you come back from come back to wherever home is at the time, from an intense kind of assignment, like Zimbabwe must have been. I was reading about
yeah.
it online, and having been to Africa last year, Africa's a whole different kettle mm-hmm. of fish. Actually, many places are in the world, that's for sure. Where do you go to holiday? And what are holidays for you like?
Well, it's funny. Coming home in itself is a process. And I've heard a lot of people say, and I kind of subscribe to this theory. I like this idea that, you know, when you get on a plane and you're leaving a place that's difficult, and when you get off the plane, you're suddenly at home and everything is okay, that really messes with your head. That notion of your boots are still dirty, but everything around you is safe. You know, it's hard. And sometimes where possible, you know, try to have a layover, even if it's just for one night, even if it's just change your clothes, decompress, have a conversation with your pals, maybe talk some things through, and then go home.
Have some pasta.
Yeah, something, yeah. Right? Anything. Then go home because, you know, you have these things that happen when you go home. Lots of people say to you, how was it? And then you think, okay, what they really kind of want to hear is, oh, it was great. And maybe one story, and then that's it. They want to move on. But you've got so much left inside you to say, and you can't take it out on your family, and you can't be a grumpy Gus wandering around the house. So you got to figure out a way to do it. Do you go to the gym? Do you, you know, call up other people who get it? And I'm not to say, and this is not to say that everything's a trauma, but it's just a different experience. Because it's really hard on the people you leave behind. So I think it's, yeah, vacation. I mean, I don't really, when I have a vacation, my impulse is not to get on a plane and go somewhere very far away and do something very adventurous. I kind of just want to pass out.
Go to Sarnia and have the, from the French fry truck under the bridge. I can highly recommend
it. That sounds good.
Yeah. And it's safe there.
So far.
Yeah, so far. So this is something that has always interested me. I'm paid to have an opinion.
Right.
You're paid to not have an opinion. Personally, you have your own opinions, of course, and you have to show both sides in a story. So how are you able to do that? How do you maintain that perfect walking the center line?
Well, you know, it's funny because it's not always a center line because there are many sides to a story and they're not always equal.
Okay.
So it's not about, you know, X side got, you know, 14 seconds versus the 12 on the other sort of thing.
Yeah.
Although a lot of people will say that's what objectivity is, but I think that's a mistake. I think what you're going for is fairness.
Fairness, you know, is exactly the right word.
How do you fairly portray what's going on? And if it's wrong, you say it's wrong. You know, but you fairly portray what is happening, that, you know, you can be tough and fair at the same time. And I think it's just coming to understand and feeling the difference in that. You know, you still have to ask very hard questions of all the different sides in the story. But at the end of the day, I mean, our goal at the end of the day is that whoever's watching at home has for a moment can almost smell it, taste it, hear it, imagine what it's like underfoot, walking through it, whatever it is. We've borrowed them for whether it's 2 minutes or 20 minutes just to give them a sensory perception of what it's like to be in place X, in situation Y, and how they would feel there. I think that's the most we can hope to accomplish in the course of one of these stories, because no one's going to say, oh, I remember all the statistics. You know, and I remember that, you know, the 15 facts that were thrown at me in the course of that very short story. It's a very hard thing to ask people to do. But if you can try to find a way to allow them to connect, then you've sort of done your job, I hope.
Does the job ever break your heart?
Oh, all the time.
How do you heal a broken heart?
Well, you know, you talk it through. The tsunami, the Sri Lankan tsunami, well, the Indonesian tsunami, really, the Indian Ocean tsunami in 2004, Boxing Day.
Yep.
So I went to Sri Lanka and I was there for a month.
And you won the award for building the name of the town that I can't pronounce. Building
Hakuda. Oh my God.
Look it up, people.
Hikkaduwa.
There you go. That's the one.
Hikkaduwa is a place where, it was terrible. There was so people were heading home on a train, and the train was moving sort of parallel to the sea. And in the tsunami, what happened is that the water got all sucked out.
Yep.
way far into the ocean and then came slamming back. And so when it slammed back, it knocked this train right off the rails. And then it went out again, and it came back and it hit it again. Repeatedly hit. These people who thought they had survived, the ones who were lucky enough to survive, kept getting hit and hit and hit and hit. There were bodies in trees, literally bodies in trees. And so when we went to Hikkaduwa, and the train was still upended, and there were piles and piles of bodies, and a lot of women and children died in the tsunami, because a lot of men were fishermen and they were out at sea, and when you're out at sea, you were okay.
Yeah.
So it was the women and the kids who were at home or heading home, and they were the ones who really bore the brunt of it. So it was, you know, there were so many things to sort of assault your senses in that moment. Aside from, like, quite literally, the smell of death was so horrific in that terrible heat.
How long after the tsunami were you there, that was Boxing Day?
I think maybe two or three days.
So very quickly thereafter, yeah.
You know, a couple of things happened in Hikkaduwa that I won't forget. There was a Canadian, a couple of weeks later, there was a Canadian therapist who arrived with some crayons and paper for the kids to draw what they had seen. And so they gathered in what had been, looked like it was maybe a little house or a train station. I couldn't really tell. So they were sitting down drawing. And as these kids were drawing, there was this lady, an elderly woman, tiny, tiny woman. She actually looked about the same height as some of the kids. She was on the sort of margins of this group. She was watching what this man was saying all by herself, and she was sort of inching ever closer to him without saying anything. And as the kids were drawing, at one point she went up to him, and she asked him if she could have a crayon and if she could have some paper. And he gave it to her, and she sat down with the children, and she started to draw what she'd seen. And, there are moments like that that just demolish you.
Mm-hmm.
Her story is that, you know, her children had died, and why on earth in her mind was she still left, and the only people she could really relate to were those kids.
Wow.
You know, so that stings. I found the men floored me in Sri Lanka, because a lot of them came back from fishing, and we were in an area called Ampara, and we were walking through what had been a community, and I was doing a piece to camera. And, you know, I was explaining what had happened, and I was walking up, and my foot sort of hit a little rock, and I kept going, and I looked down, and I realized it's not a rock, it's a skull.
Oh, my.
And I wasn't on a pile of rocks, I was on a pile of bones.
Oh, gee.
And I hadn't seen it at first. And what had happened is that, because this was a couple weeks now after the tsunami, people had started to burn the bodies. But a lot of the men had not come back to figure out what had happened to their families yet. So as they came back, they were checking from one bit of rubble, bones, to another, or a little piece of what maybe was a bed frame or something, trying to figure out where their homes had been and where their families were. And all these men, all by themselves, who'd lost their children, who'd lost their wives, and then they would go and they'd sit and look at the sea, you know, as if it was going to give up the families again. And the men were completely lost. And it's, you know, it's hard to see it, but where we're really lucky is that you write it out. You talk it out and you write it out. You put it in your stories. We have an outlet for it. And you sort of give it the respect it's due by working with it.
Is it satisfying for you? I mean, awards are one thing, but I get the feeling that you would be doing this regardless of the awards.
Sure.
That the idea of bringing these stories home to or into people's homes. Is that what feeds you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, really, it's got nothing. I mean, the awards are very nice. I think they're nice for the organization, for the CBC. In many cases, you know, that's fantastic. But, you know, it's this privilege. And what's really neat, I'm finding increasingly with technology, is that we have so many more platforms now. You know, like, thankfully, if I say to my bosses, I know you wanted 5 minutes, but can I have 17?
Please.
you know, I won't be beaten at dawn. You know, there is a place to put that. And we can do a radio version. And if it warrants it, there's an online version. And we can do something else. I mean, there are so many different ways technologically now to express what we've learned, that it is incredibly satisfying. I mean, because, you know, it used to be people would be able to, they'd shoot for weeks, they'd get one documentary out, it would air once, and there'd be so much stuff left on the floor and so much left unsaid. But we get a chance to kind of say it now. Technology gives us that opportunity.
Is there a downside, you think?
Oh, sure. It's tyrannical. Technology is totally tyrannical. I mean, if I was to attach everything to my tool belt, I wouldn't be able to walk, you know,
That's
all the
true.
Things we need to
and
do.
It would be unattractive, people.
Very
I'm
unattractive.
Just saying.
Yes.
I could sequin it up for you, though, if you
Thank
wanted
you.
To.
You know, because you lose think time. There's so much time spent doing. I mean, we can land pretty much anywhere and file pretty much instantly. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. And that's sort of what we wrestle with sometimes. And, you know, you really have to parse it out a little bit because you lose the opportunity to analyze and really think. So that's where the technology is tyrannical, a bit of a pain.
It's that whole idea of human being versus human doing.
Right. Right.
So sometimes I like to do what I call recreational thinking. I kid you not. There's nothing I like more than just thinking.
Having a good thunk.
Yeah, about nothing really in particular, obviously. I'm in sports. So what kind of stories are your favorite to cover?
Wow. You know, Joe Schlesinger once said to me, you know, you don't have a, I can't do his accent, I couldn't even try. You don't have a story unless you have a thing. And I thought, boy, that's the worst piece of advice I've ever been given in my life. And then I thought about it, I thought, you know, he's right. A thing in a story is that thing that people remember that they don't expect seeing.
Yeah.
That, hey, did you see that thing in that story? So for me, what that translates to is something you don't expect. Something in the narrative that takes you slightly by surprise and you don't expect it. That's the sense of wonder being played out. That's what I like the most, I think.
Has anything really surprised you?
Oh, all the time. Yeah, you know, what surprises me a lot is the bravery of people we see. I'm constantly shocked at how willing people are, the big decisions they make to stop and talk to you and share. I mean, we were in Libya 2 years ago, and we were in a neighborhood where, you know, it was bad. This was before Gaddafi was gone. This was still Gaddafi-controlled just outside Tripoli. A lot of people, I mean, the houses were shuttered. We were pretty much the only people, give or take a few, on the street, and those people were basically running from place to place. And we were looking for someone to talk to about how they really felt. And we thought, our chances are just complete. This is not going to happen. We're going to get ourselves in trouble here. And along comes a car that comes screeching to a halt. And this kid, and, you know, maybe he was in his 20s, it's hard to say, came running out and he said, okay, we got to do this fast. I know what you want. And he just started sharing and talking and just speaking his mind graciously and politely. And then his buddy started honking the horn like, please get in the car.
Yeah.
And so he did, and he ran away. And we were completely shocked at how, at the, you know, an act like that in a place like that is a stunning act of bravery. And that sort of, that constantly surprises me.
Do you think women's stories, women's rights have evolved around the world, or do you think that they're slipping back in some places? Or like when you're doing stories of women and children,
right.
There's still so many traditional places, like we were talking about in Sri Lanka, the men were out fishing and the women right. were at home. Does technology help women? I know that having been in Africa, the number of schools that were now sort of adopting internet and laptops, even in places where there wasn't a lot of electricity, it was fascinating to me to see the world becoming much smaller.
For a bunch of things in there, absolutely becoming a lot smaller. You know, there are incredibly brave women. Pakistan is a place where I have seen some of the bravest women I've ever encountered in my life. You know, you think of young Malala Yousafzai, a little girl from Mingora Swat, who was pushing for child, you know, education for girls and was frankly shot in the head for it. Who is alive mercifully and not the only. You know, there are a lot of Malalas in Pakistan, and I'm amazed by them. And a lot of women there take the initiative and basically push for their own rights. And there are a lot of enlightened men who are backing them as
well.
Yeah,
for sure.
So you absolutely see that. You know, I've also been in places where I've been treated like an honorary man in the sense that, you know, the men eat first and the women eat what's left. And so I've been, you know, invited to eat with the men. And it's really hard, you know, to eat with the men. And you look at the women and you think, everything I put in my mouth is one thing they can't have for themselves or their kids. I mean, you almost can't get down.
You must be almost a curiosity, though, in some places in the
world.
Oh,
for sure. For sure.
They're kind of going, you know.
What is that?
Yeah.
No, it's true. And you know, sometimes when you end up in certain cases being a team leader and maybe you are the one who's talking to the driver about where we need to go or you're handling the money, it is an oddity for people sometimes. Kids are always, you know, kids are great wherever you go. Lots of fingers, you know, hanging onto belts and pant legs and, you know, touching your hair. And I mean, that happens with people who travel all over the world anyway. But, yeah, I think we're oddities generally. Lots of questions about where are your children, why are you here, that sort of stuff.
Do you know what's so interesting to me? And I've had this discussion before with fellow sports kinds of people. Mm-hmm. I believe that when I go into a country, I believe that I'm the guest. So I'm very respectful of whatever the rules are in that person's home country. I don't live there. It's not my permanent home. And I've had discussions with fellow sports types who've said, tough, they've got to do it my way. I believe that you get the best from where you are if you're respectful of who you're
company with. Well, you have to be.
I believe so.
You have to be. You are a guest in whatever. I mean, you have to abide by the laws of the land, like them or not.
And is it hard to know them all then?
Well, you have to. You have to be really careful. Almost always, we'll work with someone on the ground who's either a local journalist or someone who's just very connected locally, speaks English as well as whatever the particular language we're dealing with is. And that person and the driver, I mean, we put our lives in their hands and on many, many levels. And discussing societal norms is a big deal. That's a big part of it. You know, we are not in the business of making enemies when we travel. We cannot afford to make enemies.
No, of course not.
You know, we need people to confide in us. We need them to trust us. We need them to see that we respect them. And we need to get out. And we need to get out safely. And we need to make sure the people we leave behind aren't in jeopardy. So we spend a lot of time trying to make nice. I actually think it's, you know, people who barge their way into places, unless you're doing some sort of accountability thing where you're trying to expose something horrific that's happening right in front of you, barge away. But if not, you got to be really careful.
Well, I think you do too. And I think, again, how people live in their own worlds is not necessarily something that we can understand because we're not there every day. And we weren't raised that way from little girls, right? Mm-hmm. So it's fascinating to me and I find that I'm always able to get more information by respecting sort of where they are, and just then I can find out, well, why do you think of these things this way? You know what I mean?
So I mean, you wouldn't want to confide in a jerk. You know,
No. Someone
who is being completely horrible to you or didactic or a bully. I mean, you'd certainly keep your mouth shut.
Me? Don't be silly. What's the happiest story you've ever worked on?
Wow. The happiest story. Oh, there are lots of those. You know, a lot of the sports stories end up being happy stories. I was in Beijing when Carol Huynh won her gold medal. And it was Canada's first gold medal. I think
you may be right.
And I was sitting with her parents in the stands.
Oh, neat.
And, you know, they were basically, the story basically is that they hadn't spent a lot of time watching her wrestle in their whole lives. You know, although once her dad said that he had snuck into the school gym and had watched through a half-open door just to see what on earth she was doing all these nights when she would go and work out and come home so tired. But they were sobbing. They were completely sobbing with glee. You know, it's a family who came as refugees. They were welcomed by their community in BC. They'd worked so hard within the community. They were so embraced by the community. And then for her to win a gold medal for Canada, they were completely floored. And, you know, what a great day.
Did your eyes well up?
I am the Hallmark card of reporters sometimes. I get very connected. And I sort of defend that a little bit because I've heard a lot of people say, you know, that you have to detach yourselves. And that's true. You know, you really have to steel yourself for a lot of stuff. But I genuinely believe, and I'm willing to be corrected on this, that if you don't feel what's happening around you, if you can't connect with it both intellectually and emotionally, y'all better go home.
Well, the other thing is, I think that one of the reasons why you have achieved the success that you have is that I believe in your humanity.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
If you are, because when I watch you, when I see you reporting on stories, even heartbreaking stories, the fact that you're presenting all the facts, which is what your job is, but I also feel that it means something to you. So rather than it just being words on a page, it I think that that's the difference. So I agree with you.
I think it has to. I think, and I think if I don't connect with it as the reporter or the messenger, then I cannot expect Martha, who lives in Moose Jaw, to connect with it either. And she's my number one, she's my boss.
Yep.
Is making sure that the people on the receiving end of what we do, whether it's print, radio, or TV, those are the people we work for.
And are they ever in contact with you?
Sure.
What do they want to know?
Well, you know, it's really funny. I wrestle with this a little bit because Twitter's fantastic. I'm a terrible tweeter. I'm more of a squatter than
we'll
a
fix
tweeter.
That, people.
Thank
don't
you.
Worry.
I have a Twitter account. I'm fascinated
at
by
Adri
it.
Arsenault.
Oh, there we go. I don't. It's knowing how and when to engage with people is difficult because you could do it all day long.
Yes, you could.
And some things are fantastic. Some are terrible. I mean, I have literally had one a couple weeks ago where a woman said, "Not only are you a racist, you are a something something. Go kill yourself."
Lovely.
And I thought, wow, you know what? Now I just ignored it.
Yeah.
Because I thought, wow, okay. I don't know whether I should engage. I mean, we're all learning the rules of social media. You know, that comes into my hand, and I had my BlackBerry, you know, sitting in my safe zone in my home, and up comes a message from a stranger telling me to go kill myself. I for a moment I thought, is this what little kids feel like when they get bullied via text message or Facebook at home? You know, kids used to leave bullying in the school grounds, and
yeah.
Then they'd go home to a safe zone, but it leaks in. And for that moment, I thought, okay, I'm starting to, now I kind of, you know, it was just a couple messages and I ignored it and it went away. But I thought, wow, what if I was a little kid? I can sort of connect. So yes, people tell you all the time, and 99% of the time people are fantastic. They have story ideas, they want to engage on something, and they want to, you know, want to know your opinions on stuff, or they're just chatting. And I think it's the technology has made it amazingly accessible, because previously people would write to us in a newsroom and there'd be one person who would open the letters and then decide to unpass them or not, or someone would transcribe all the voicemail messages that came in overnight, and there was such a barrier between the audience and us. And now, I mean, clearly there's no barrier anymore at all, and that's maybe how it should be.
I like it. I like the fact that people are much more accessible, and I like the fact that if somebody is on Twitter, if they themselves are on Twitter, I think that that's the best. I think sometimes when people leave negative messages, my view is, because I've had my fair mm-hmm. share of them, it's more about them than it is about you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm one of those people that will often, because I don't like people pecking away at other people, I will often call people on that and say, "You're obviously having a very bad day.
Yeah.
Have you had your fiber?"
Yeah. but where do you stop? You know,
I know.
Because
I know.
What if I go after the person who tells me to go kill myself? What if I say, "Easy there," you know, like,
settle down.
And then
I know
all the people who follow me start attacking that person too. I don't know where that person comes from.
I don't know anything about them. I know. And it's just, I agree with you there. When it's something that's that tricky, keep an eye on it.
Yeah.
So I've got another couple of quick questions. One is, I'd like to know the most surprising moment of hospitality that you've enjoyed working.
Oh. There's so many of them.
Top two.
I was in Rafah in Gaza, in the Gaza Strip a number of years ago, and we blundered our way into Rafah. It was probably kind of a mistake. We ended up being just ahead of an Israeli incursion without realizing it was about to happen. So all the other smart journalists were behind the lines, and we were bumbling our way through the streets, and we could not get out. It was very clear that we weren't going to get out. And I don't know where these people came from, but because it was our fixer and driver who kindly arranged this, but we had a place to stay. They brought us food. I tried to pay them for the accommodation, absolutely refused to hear of it. They had somebody keep watch on the door all night long.
Wow.
And they made sure that our car was protected. And when the morning came, they said, we'll be here again tonight if you need us.
Wow.
Meanwhile, there was all sorts of stuff, booms and bangs going off all night long. And they had families to worry about, and they were worried about us. So you see things like this that happen that just completely shock you. But increasingly, the less people have, the more they give.
I've noticed that too.
It's really interesting.
It is interesting because it really defines hospitality. Mm-hmm. Because it's not about being able to take you to whatever fancy steakhouse. It's about, when I was in Africa, I was in a couple of places where people were truly dirt poor. And still, enough wood for a fire, enough wood to make chai and to have white bread. It was so touching. I can't even... Puts me to shame, truly.
Well, it does. It makes you want to be a better person. And that's kind of what I like about all this stuff is you come back and you want to, you know, you sort of want to pull up your socks a bit and stand up straight and realize that, you know.
Get your matching socks on,
yes,
for heaven's sake.
Yes, my mom would be so proud, finally. I'm not even sure they're matching today, to be honest.
Oh, well, we'll check later. I just have one other question. Well, two, actually. I'm lying. One is, have you ever been afraid?
Sure. I think if the fear button gets turned off, it's time to recalibrate.
Okay.
I mean, you don't want to be paralyzed with fear because that's a danger to your colleagues too. You don't want to be the one that they have to drag out of a situation. You never want to be a burden on your team, and that's sort of a pressure within the team too, that you don't want to be the one that they have to worry about. A little bit of fear is really important. It keeps you completely alert. It's exhausting to go through a period of a day because not everything is scary for the entire day. You might have 10 minutes of complete, oh no, what on earth is happening here? And then it's calm for 3 hours and then it hits again. So, I've been scared for sure.
And here's my final question. It's one of my favorite questions, actually.
Oh, no.
I want to know how you would answer this question, or finish the statement, really. I am
a reporter.
Love it. Erin Arsenal, thank you for talking to me.
My pleasure. It was fun.
So I thought that was great. And one thing that I'm always fascinated by is how the media, I've always been so interested in media and how news is presented and communicated and the different ways there are of doing that. And one thing that I really liked that she talked about was how she seemed kind of excited about the technology and all these different ways that you can get the news out there. And she seemed sort of to see the potential in all of this stuff.
Well, the thing that I thought was wonderful, too, and that really speaks to me, is, you know, you shoot and you write and you do all these things around a certain subject or around a certain story. And as she said, in the old days, you know, a documentary was shown once and then it was gone and there was all this wonderful footage that was on the floor. And she said, now you can take all these other elements and you can craft them into something else. So if people want to know more, there's more information. And I just think that the internet is wonderful. Like, look at us here today. Who would have thought 10 years ago that we could have our own little talk show here in, you know, the basement of my house?
Well, and just some of the stories that we just heard, it's almost like you can see the news story that had to be clipped out of and made of, you know, whatever, whether she was talking about the tsunami or, you know, being in the Gaza Strip,
yeah,
and all,
or Zimbabwe.
Or Zimbabwe. you can sort of see, okay, this would be the snippets that they would need to sort of send back to for their work here. But all of the stuff that's just happening day to day and in between all of that, you know, it sounds like she's just lived had a lot of very interesting and experiences,
and not all easy.
No.
And you know, that was the other thing that I was thinking of, you know, as I was preparing for the interview. I was reading a lot and looking back over what I could find in Adrian's career, just so that I would be, you know, on top of my research, let's say. And I thought about the things that she must have seen. And then when she told me that story of her foot hitting what she thought was a rock on the beach, and finding out that she was walking on piles of bones. I mean, that image to me is just so beyond powerful. I think about that and I wonder, I couldn't do that job, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
I could not detach myself enough, although I recognize the importance in bringing those stories home. Hats off to Adrienne Arsenault and the team of professionals that she has working with her, because that is an amazing but impossible job.
Well, and I just found it was very insightful to just hear how they do that, because you see these people on TV and you see them in these sort of these volatile kind of places that look dangerous,
and they are dangerous,
and like they're not reporting from somewhere up on a balcony of a tall building and it's all happening behind them. They're right in there, and it's just sort of interesting hearing about all of those sort of day-to-day things and how they actually get it done and all the little sort of things that they have to do.
You know, in my childlike mind, I always imagined that people that were in a position like Adrian's, traveling the world, covering really hard stories sometimes, and big stories for news, I always imagined that they had kind of like a bubble surrounding them, sort of like if they touched the tree, it was like home free, you know, like when you play when you're a child. But I realized, you know, as I got older, of course, and in talking to her, there is no home free when you're covering stories.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to rely on the people around you. You have to rely on yourself. And I think you have to really know that what you're doing is an important job. So
mm-hmm.
more power to her. She's on Twitter, by the way, at Adri Arsenault. And I think that she has some wonderful writing that's sitting on the CBC website. And I'm just a huge fan, and I just really appreciate her generosity in talking to us.
And you can talk to us.
Yay.
On Twitter at OpenKwangDoor. You can email us, contact@openkwangdoor.com, or just visit our website and say hello, openkwangdoor.com.
Thanks, everybody.